Diane. Great to be with you. On my mind, the terrible devastation to Puerto Rico. Like many of you, I'm so concerned about the crisis unfolding there and anxious to see aid arrive soon. This week on the podcast, I sat down with one of my favorite authors, Alice McDermott, to talk about her new novel, The Ninth Hour, and why, in her writing, she continues to return to the Catholic Church.
We are human beings, and we suffer. What does that mean? How do we even talk about it? And I still find there, in this very flawed institution, an opportunity to consider those questions.
Then, as I read Alice's novel last weekend, I was struck by the image of football players kneeling. Seemed almost religious to me. It turned out others had the same thought.
As a Catholic, it's really kind of strange, the whole controversy, because in the Catholic Church, kneeling is a sign of respect.
We'll get the Catholic Church perspective on taking a knee. But first, here's Alice McDermott. I cannot tell you what a joy it is to see you again.
Oh, well, thank you so much. It wouldn't feel like a publication if I didn't get to talk to you.
Well, I can say, without bias, it is a gorgeous book.
Oh, thank you so much.
It contains love. It contains forgiveness. It contains the sin of every human being, the kinds of ways we try to overcome those sins. But I won't say more. I want you to tell us first about the title, The Ninth Hour.
The Ninth Hour. Well, I'll tell you, originally I wanted to title this book The Hour of Known, N-O-N-E, which in the Divine Office, the Liturgy of Prayers of the Hours, is about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. But I understood that there would be readers who would see the hour of N-O-N-E, and since we're not all up on our Latin, might pronounce it as the hour of none.
Exactly.
And it would seem like a very bad pun for a book about nursing sisters. So it became The Ninth Hour. But the purpose of the title, and I think the overall meaning of the title, is related very much to that 3 o'clock hour. In the Christian tradition, this is the hour in which Christ dies on the cross. In the Old Testament tradition, it's the hour of sacrifice. And what struck me thinking about this hour, this time, both for the need of sacrifice and the moment after the sacrifice has been made, it struck me that this must be a moment of great stillness. Among believers, it's the moment that uncertainty must reign. The man who you hoped was God's gift, or the sacrifice that you hoped would bring blessing, is done, and nothing has been proven. And I see it as a moment when believer and non-believer alike hold their breath with hope, but also with a kind of despair. So for a novel that essentially for me is a story about selflessness, sacrifice, but also selfishness and the individual, I was intrigued by this notion of uncertainty.
And uncertainty certainly begins the novel with the suicide of a young man who is married. His wife is pregnant. He has just learned that but he's also just lost his job.
Yes.
And when he tells his pregnant wife that he has just lost his job, she tells him that she has just learned she is pregnant. So he can't face it.
Yes, well, his impulse is to claim his own life entirely for himself, to say that the most precious commodity that he owns is his own time. And in order to prove that, he feels he can demonstrate how much he owns his own life by taking it. It's his own. And so his obligations to his wife, to his unborn child, to the world around him, do not in any way supersede his sense of it's my own time and I can do with it what I wish.
And as a result of his suicide, there is a disaster in the building in which he lives, which brings the police and also brings a very weary nun
yes.
who has been collecting pennies on the street into the apartment. The policeman sort of brags that he called her, but in fact, she had simply walked in. But she does internally say, he's one of us because of the manner in which he treats her, a nun in full habit.
Yes, the nun notices that the policeman has smoothed the counterpane on the bed where young Jim died, neatened it up again, and she recognizes that as a compassionate soul, one of us. But I have to say, my original intentions for the novel, actually, the idea that began the novel had more to do with a conversation I had with a friend about substitutes in the Civil War. That was my first, yes, I hadn't thought about that. That whole idea that during the Civil War you could pay your own mercenary to take your place.
And it wasn't a huge sum.
No, yeah. Well, it varied.
Maybe
over the years.
Then.
Yes, yeah. I mean, it was as much as $300, but it varied historically through the years. And that was what got me thinking about this whole notion of sacrifice, which life is more valuable, and then what obligation do you have if someone has sacrificed either their life or limb so that you might live? How many generations need to be grateful to that person? So I thought that's what I was sort of after. And when I wrote that first chapter, that whole idea of selfishness being illustrated by selflessness and those two things vying for each other, Sister Saint Savior comes into the story, and she comes in sort of inadvertently. She's just on her way back to the convent. It's a dreary day. She's been sitting begging, which is what the nuns who were no longer physically able to do nursing often were given the job of, just begging for money. She just wants to get back to her convent. and she sees that this fire has happened because because he filled the apartment with gas, someone lights a match and there's a fire in the apartment. And she wearily says, of course, she has to go up and see what happens. But looking back, I realized Sister Saint Savior got into the novel and suddenly this was going to be a novel about nuns, whether I wanted it to be her or not.
Now, that's fascinating. In other words, your conscious mind was leading you in one direction where your unconscious mind was taking you in a
different direction. Absolutely. This is where as a writer, you have to briefly give up all control and say, yes, these are characters who want in. I'm not even quite sure who they are yet, but I've got to let them in and find out.
And Sister Saint Xavier is such a marvelous and strong character. She's not happy being out there on the street begging. She wants to be involved in nursing, but at the same time realizes she is getting older. She's not strong enough to do that work.
Yes, and she has a strong sense of herself. And this is the thing that sort of began to immediately fascinate me about women in the convent, especially at this time, working among the poor. You know, one of the lovely things that that religious life gives us and reading about religious life gives us is the marvelous naming of things, the beautiful use of language that comes through various organized religions. And orders of nuns have some of the most marvelous and fanciful names. And I did sort of create my own order here, an amalgam of a number of orders that I knew of and that I had read about. But it struck me immediately that a name like the Little Nursing Sisters of the Sick Poor, Congregation of Mary Before the Cross.
Oh.
You know, there's two things in that name. There's tremendous humility, using little and small and humble in the naming of these orders is quite common. Tremendous humility, tremendous self-effacement, and right along with that, in the name of the order itself, tremendous hubris. We are just little sisters, but we are going to stand up against suffering in the world, you know. And I think Sister Saint Xavier embodies both those things.
And she does that early on as she meets the wife of the man who has taken his own life. She and he have bought plots,
yes,
in the Calvary Cemetery. And she fears, the young woman fears, that because her husband has taken his life, that perhaps he will not, the Catholic Church,
yes,
will not allow him to be buried there. And yet, what Sister says is to herself, we'll see about that.
Right, exactly. I mean, it's really up until fairly recent, the Catholic Church would not allow a suicide to be buried in consecrated ground. Sister Saint Xavier, who is more about compassion than rules, understands the injustice of this. She asked Annie, you paid for that plot, right? If you paid for it, you should be able to use it. So she thinks she can pull some strings. She's been in the neighborhood a long time. She knows the funeral director very well. Lots of people owe her favors. She thinks she can pull some strings and get a suicide buried in the cemetery, the Catholic cemetery, before anybody realizes it.
Now, the young wife, as we move forward, has a place in that convent. How did they make room for her?
They, again, Sister Saint Xavier as a great manipulator, as she's cleaning up the apartment where the suicide happens, she's remaking the bed, and she finds a sheet that has been repaired, and the stitches are very fine.
Beautiful stitches.
Beautiful stitches. So she knows here's something Annie can do. So she arranges for Annie to work with Sister Illuminata, who is the laundress at the convent. Sister Saint Xavier does another thing that, and this is actually based on the historical record, a lot of the convents would have either a statue of the Blessed Mother or the infant Jesus out front, and they would write little requests, things that the church needed or that the convent needed or that people in the neighborhood needed, and slip them under the statue. And the kind, wealthier women in the neighborhood would take those little requests and make them happen. So Sister Saint Xavier asks for a little bit of money so that they can hire Annie to work with Sister Illuminata. And there's another wonderful
name.
It's sort of there's a kind of humility in it. But anybody who has the nerve to take as her own name Illuminata has depths that that are worth exploring.
Alice McDermott, you dedicate the book to Sister Mary Rose. Tell us about her.
Yes, and here's another place where the process of writing the novel, or in many ways for me discovering the novel, led me to things I hadn't expected. As I was writing the novel and realizing that, all right, the nuns are in, and they've gotten in
here
the door,
to stay.
And they're
yeah.
here to stay.
Right?
They are taking over. They are leading the way. I slowly began to recall from my own childhood, and I would say very young childhood, a nun who had helped my mother's family. My mother was raised by a widowed aunt who had four children of her own. She was a working woman, again, back at the start of the 20th century. She was an immigrant. And Sister Mary Rose would be there to babysit, to help with dinner, to take care of them when they got sick. And I'd heard, you know, stories about her just sort of in a vague way. But as I was writing the book, I recalled something I had not recalled in ages. And that was an encounter I had with Sister Mary Rose, who was a very old nun. And I think I was very young. And she was in our house, and she reached into her deep nun pockets and brought out a little figure of the infant Jesus and gave it to me and said, when Christmas comes, you can put this in the manger. And for some reason, I have changed, you know, homes and moved back and forth across the country, and my parents got rid of the house, and they moved. Of all the things I've lost, I still have that and put it in the manger. And I must say, I hardly ever think about her. I know that's where I got it. But as I was writing the book, I felt her come back to me. And I recalled a sense of awe. And I guess it was a kind of holiness that, to my childish eyes, was embodied in this tiny little nun in the old-fashioned habit. So I had to, when it was finished, I had to say, I don't know what part you had in this, sister, but I will dedicate it to you.
But Alice, when you think about the characters in your book, when you think about the nuns as they are trying their very best to do good and to be helpful, some of your other characters take a different path.
Well, I think the important thing for me when I realized what kind of portraits I was drawing was to constantly understand that each and every one of these characters is a complex human being. That the reasons for the vocation among the nuns, the reason for the faithfulness among the other women, the lives that they were just trying to manage, should each be unique. And I think many of our views of religious sisters in the 21st century are distorted by so many of us who remember encounters with nuns, remember grammar school encounters with nuns. So they were clowns, they were witches, they hit us with rulers, they yelled at us. And I wanted to work against that as much as I could, not to say any of those things didn't happen. I know they happened. But to make sure that each character, as she or he appeared, was true to the character himself, herself, and not to some expectations that we might bring to it.
And we are all human, filled with truthfulness, filled with lies, filled with diversions, filled with hope, and filled with anger.
Absolutely, absolutely. And even the best of these sisters are no way excused from all the things that make us human.
Alice, what do you think of what's happening in the Roman Catholic Church today?
It's still discouraging, I think, for women who are identifying still as practicing Catholics. Better, perhaps, with Pope Francis. Dialogue has opened a little bit. Discouraging still when priests like Father James Martin, who is advocating for opening our arms to the LGBTQ community, is disinvited from a seminary. Discouraging still when a conservative Catholic judge is questioned about, does she understand the difference between dogma and law? And yet she's defended by priests who say that's anti-Catholic because, a woman can be both a practicing conservative Catholic and an impartial judge. But these are guys who are also saying, but she can't be a priest because she's a woman. So I think there's this hope springs eternal, but still a rolling of the eyes and a constant discouragement because we're holding on to so many mistakes. As Sister Saint Xavier points out, compassion should rule us. That's the example of Christ. Compassion for the individual should rule us, not some set of rules that we made up that no longer apply. Now suicides can be buried in Catholic cemeteries because we recognize suicide is not a sin. It's something else entirely. So when you see those medieval leftovers still being clung to by the church, you take a deep breath. You continue to hope for the best.
And yet almost not a month goes by without another revelation of some high-ranking priest or bishop or cardinal being accused and found guilty of hurting young children.
Absolutely. Yes. And I think this is what, I think all of us who are sentient Catholics, you're constantly rethinking and doubting and questioning. And certainly the abuse crisis has brought many people to the brink and beyond, saying, that's it, I don't want anything else to do with this institution. But I think all novelists are contrarians, and I count myself a contrarian as much as I am a novelist. So for me, it's, yes, I recognize the tragedy of that. And I recognize how it has shaken the moral authority of the church so thoroughly, almost to erase it. But the contrarian in me says, all right, but what's worth preserving? So where's the good of it? Can the actions of these people, and compassion demands us to be compassionate in viewing the terrible things they've done, too. Put that aside. Where's the value? Is there still value? And I think that's what brings me as a writer back to ritual, language, and a place where what I think we don't confront much in our contemporary life, and that is, what is the answer to suffering? What is the place of suffering? We are human beings, and we suffer, and we can't cure ourselves of that. What does that mean? What does that say about us? How do we even talk about it? And I still find there, in this this very flawed institution, an opportunity to consider those questions.
But finally, as you write about the nuns themselves are diminishing in number. Their riches non-existent to begin with.
Yes.
I mean, have left so many of them who have served the people, who have served the church in utter poverty.
Yes, yes. And again, this is the great sin of the Roman Catholic Church, and I see it embodied in the inequality of women from the top to the bottom. I've done so much reading, obviously, in the last few years about religious orders, women's religious orders, and have been gobsmacked by how much these women accomplished in the United States, all over the world. And it continues. It continues. The fact that they're not getting the credit they deserve is just absolutely of a whole cloth. I've been telling people at readings, just because this is not in the novel, but it's just something that I want to impress. The Mayo Clinic was founded by Catholic nuns. In Rochester, Minnesota, St. Mary's Hospital was built by the St. Francis Order of teaching nuns. And a tornado had come through the city, and the people who were hurt in the weather were brought into barns and into front parlors. And the nuns who were teaching order looked around and said, "We need a hospital." And they went to the Mayo brothers and the Mayo father. The father was 70 at the time. The two brothers were in their 20s. And the nuns said to them, "If we build a hospital, will you be our attending physicians?" And they said, and this is the historical record, "I don't think that's going to happen. There's a lot of anti-Catholicism around here. You're not even nurses. Why would you build a hospital in the middle of nowhere?" And they said, "Will you be our attending physicians? Very much, if we build it, will you come? And the nuns, it was St. Mary's Hospital, the nuns built it. Within a few years, it had the lowest mortality rate of any hospital in the country, which is why people began to travel to go to the Mayo Clinic. Now, I've been told in the Episcopal Church, the Mayo doctors are acknowledged as saints. In the Catholic Church, we don't even know the names of those nuns.
Wow.
Yeah.
Quite a story. Well, Alice McDermott, the nuns in this world have a new champion in you. I'm so glad you've written this book.
Thank you so much, Diane.
And thank you. Now, a quick break. And we're back. Father Thomas Rees is a senior analyst for Religion News Service. His recent column is "Kneeling at NFL Liturgies." Father Rees, I wonder, as a priest, what your own reaction was to the whole controversy about kneeling during the national anthem?
Well, as a Catholic, it's really kind of strange, the whole controversy, because in the Catholic Church, kneeling is a sign of respect, not a sign of disrespect. In the Catholic Church, we kneel at the most sacred times during the Mass. And so it's a very strange controversy that we're having. In some ways, for a Catholic, if we saw people kneeling in front of the American flag, we'd say, is that idolatrous? So this attack on people who are kneeling comes across to me as quite strange.
You know, in Episcopal churches, I'm sure you know, we are standing more frequently than we are kneeling. In fact, I rarely see kneelers in church anymore. So standing at attention has become, during the sacred parts of the service, which are all sacred, equally acceptable.
You're absolutely right. And actually, in most parts of the world, in the Catholic Church, we do a lot more standing now than we do in Catholic churches in the United States. During the Eucharistic prayer, which is the central prayer during the Mass, the Vatican playbook, I guess I could say, the Roman Missal, says that the congregation should stand during that period.
Interesting.
But the bishops in the United States argued that, no, we have a different way of approaching things in the United States. We kneel, and the people, the Catholic people in the United States, would be shocked if we asked them to stand. It shows you how symbolic gestures, symbolic actions can be interpreted in different ways by different people. And that can cause some confusion. And it also shows you that sometimes you have to explain symbols and symbolic action to people. For example, I don't think there's anything wrong with standing during the Mass, during the Eucharistic prayer. But, we'd have to explain that to the people, Catholic people in the United States, because they're just not used to it.
So what about standing and linking arms, as many in the NFL have done? Some have kneeled, some have stood, some have linked arms while standing. It's all very confusing to people.
It can be. But in a way, I kind of like it, because it's a sign of diversity, a diversity of opinion, and yet a respect for the opinions of others. I think that's so American, that we respect the right of people to have different views. We accept the right of people to speak their minds. And even if we disagree, we defend their right to speak. And I think that is really so American.
Now, in the Jewish tradition, of course, men wear skull caps into the service. How might that be interpreted in other churches?
Well, yeah, that's very interesting, because in the Catholic Church, when men come into the church, they're supposed to take off their hats, except, of course, for bishops who wear mitres.
Right.
But it shows you how the very same action in one situation can be seen as a sign of respect, and in a totally different situation can be seen as a sign of disrespect. That's why, the cultural context, the historical context, all of these things matter when you're trying to interpret what a symbol means, what a symbolic action means.
Well, but who gets to decide what that symbolic action mittens?
That's a great question, because who has the right to interpret these symbolic actions and symbols? In a hierarchical church like the Catholic Church, it's typically the clergy and the Pope who has the last word. It looks like President Trump thinks he's the Pope of the NFL. He's claiming the right to interpret these actions by these players. But in most circumstances, you go to the artist, you go to the creator of the symbol, you go to the community that created this symbol, and they have the first right to interpret these symbols, these symbolic actions in an authentic and authoritative way. And so if they say that kneeling during the national anthem is a protest against racism and is not an attack on the American flag, then I think we should respect their interpretation. They are the creators of this symbol, and normally those are the people who we allow to interpret this symbol to the rest of the community.
So what do you make of President Trump's attacks on the NFL? What's your reaction?
Well, you know, my reaction is like many people. I kind of think, you know, doesn't he have more important things to deal with than this? We are Americans. We don't take orders even from the president. We do what we think is right. They're not breaking any law. We respect people's rights to express themselves, even when we don't. I mean, a lot of people say things I don't like, but you don't. In the United States, you don't shut down the conversation. You don't shut down the dialogue.
Father Rees, you end the piece you wrote with an anecdote about a high school where your brother is president. Talk about that.
Yes, my brother is president of St. Ignatius College Prep, a Jesuit high school in San Francisco. And last year, three of the students, you know, saw what was happening in the NFL, and they were football players. And they said, you know, we'd like to kneel during the national anthem, too. And so they came to my brother, and they were good kids. They didn't surprise the school. They talked about it first. And my brother's response was to tell them, you know, have you talked this over with your teammates? And they said, oh, yeah, maybe that'd be a good idea. So that's what they did. They sat down with their teammates, explained what they wanted to do, explained why, and they had a really good conversation and dialogue. In fact, there was one player who was a refugee who had come to this country, and the player's life had been saved because this country had welcomed them to the country. So that player very strongly defended the country. So it was a wonderful dialogue and conversation. And the result was that when the three students knelt, some of the players knelt with them, but the others stood behind them and put their hands on each other's shoulders. So they showed a real solidarity, whether they knelt or whether they stood. And my conclusion of all that is I wish the adults in this conversation could be as mature as these high school students were.
Oh, boy, are you right. I mean, what a lovely way for them to come together, to discuss the issue, to hear that refugee's point of view, and then to come together in that way. It's just beautiful. I can imagine those young men working together in that way. So here we are now, and the controversy continues with the president suggesting that anyone who doesn't stand at attention in the NFL for the American flag ought to be fired. What's your thinking?
Oh, I think that's crazy. My brother had exactly the same problem. He got inundated with emails and phone calls and letters telling him he should expel these students from the school. And luckily, he's an experienced administrator and, you know, has a thick skin, so he did not back down. He supported the students. But, you know, that's, I just don't think that's American. In America, we let people express their views. We let people talk, and we listen to them. And, you know, for him to interpret this as an insult to the flag, when the very people who are doing it are saying, no, that's not what we mean. What we are criticizing and challenging is racism in this country. Well, I think that's something that all of us can rally around.
Father Tamasri, it's so good to talk with you. I can't thank you enough for being with us and for writing your piece on kneeling for Religion News Service.
Thank you very much.
And that's it for this week. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email to drpodcast@wamu.org or leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851 or go to our website, dianereem.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden, comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. Our engineer is Timothy Olmsted. The show is produced by Sandra Baker and Rebecca Kaufman, with help this week from Allison Brody. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.